From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, in for Robin Young and Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And let's start in Greece. The country's financial situation grows more critical by the day as voters look ahead to Sunday's referendum, which could determine Greece's future in the eurozone. But no matter how the vote goes, here's one clear way to better understand the intense impact this economic crisis is already having on average Greeks. Almost 20% of the country's population cannot meet its food needs. And the government can't help, so citizen-run solidarity groups are stepping in. Alexander Theodoridis is co-founder of Borome. His group distributed 500,000 meals around Greece during the first 3 months of this year alone. He joins us now from Athens. And Alexander, I wonder if you could give us a picture. What does it look like, for example, on grocery store shelves right now?
Well, I can tell you that, you know, what I did, what I've experienced myself. 2 days ago, I went to the supermarket, and indeed, the shelves with pasta, rice, and tomato sauce were, you know, diminishing. Their shelves were getting empty, and that's the first time in my life that I've seen that. Yesterday, I was speaking in a meat market with a guy, and he was telling me that, you know, next Tuesday, Wednesday, it will be difficult to get beef because we're not importing anything right now, and we're not producing beef meat, so basically nobody knows what will happen come Monday.
I mean, Greece has been in a crisis. Obviously, that crisis is especially acute this week with the banks closing and severely restricting the kinds of withdrawals that people can make. Who do the Greeks themselves that you speak to, who do they hold responsible for this? Because it is quite disturbing to hear that a growing number of Greeks have to look to private organizations to get enough to eat.
Yes, well, it's not a black or white situation, as you can imagine. It's a very complex matter that has its roots in the past decades of bad politics that started probably in the 80s, and now it has resulted after several decades of bad government that has a different understanding about our position in Europe and our position in the world altogether. So it depends actually of who you ask in order to get to where he's going to point the finger of blame. But if you ask me, it is, you know, many people are to blame. The governments before that actually brought us to that economic situation in the past years, and the government now as well, because they have been not very responsible in the way that they have been handling this situation.
Well, it seems very clear that in terms of a social safety net, the Greek government has been unable to meet the needs of many Greek citizens. And these so-called solidarity groups have really stepped in. I mean, I wonder if you think that even if these solidarity groups are going to become a permanent part of civil society there in Greece.
Yes, that is a fantastic question. I mean, civil society has not had deep roots in this country for many reasons. And now we are witnessing in the past years a second wave, if I can put it like that, of growth of new NGOs like ours, who are tackling matters that the state is unable to do. And let me clarify that in our understanding, NGOs will never get the position of a social welfare state. That is impossible. Even Bill Gates, giving $100 billion, says that I could never replace, and it's not my aim to replace, a social welfare state. This is not what we want to do. We just want to help as much as we can with our own means, okay? And of course, as you say, because the state has been stepping down from many areas, because it just doesn't have the money anymore to do that, more and more NGOs are sprouting and trying to help more and people in need right now in our society. And in a couple of years, you'll come and have your vacation here, and we'll meet for a coffee in Athens, and everything looks fine. I hope that, you know, the second wave of NGOs started from a very bad situation like this crisis will have been established, and a new understanding of civil society will be in place and will be there to stay for good.
Finally, Alexander, I'm just curious, if I may ask, do you know how you're going to vote on the referendum this weekend?
Absolutely. I'm half German, half Greek. I've studied in Munich, in Germany, and in London. I've lived many years abroad. And I understand myself first as a Greek and second as a European, and but not very far away the one from another. And I see myself in this continent, and I understand that I'm fully aware that the only chance that we have in the future to have some growth and get out of this crisis is within the European institutions and not outside of them.
Well, Alexander Theodoridis is co-founder of Borome, or We Can. That's an organization that connects food donations to aid distributors in Greece. He's speaking to us today from Athens. Alexander, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, back here in the U.S., earlier this week, the state of Arizona reached a settlement with the families of the 19 elite firefighters who died in the Yarnell Hill fire 2 years ago. The state agreed to pay them a total of $670,000 and agreed to change the way it fights wildfires with increased safety training and better tracking equipment. But the effects of the fire linger, especially in the community the firefighters died trying to protect. Yarnell, about 80 miles north of Phoenix, lost 127 homes. The tiny town was devastated, and people wondered if it would ever recover. Stina Sieg from Here and Now contributor KJZZ reports.
The Granite Mountain Hotshots were in a remote spot just outside of Yarnell when they became trapped by a wall of flames. They deployed their portable fire shelters, but it was no use. It was the largest loss of firefighters to one event since the September 11th attacks, and the community hasn't forgotten the sacrifice. Once a year, locals gather under a big white tent in the center of town and share stories of the fire. Somehow, there's more gratitude in the air than sorrow, even for those who've lost the most.
Garrett Zupiger, who by virtue of his last name is always the last on the list, was my grandson, our only grandchild, actually.
Lou and Marcy Theokas have lived a short ways up the road in Peoples Valley for years, but never felt part of the community like they have since the fire. And it's not just about that purple ribbon a stranger left on a tree outside their home. Lou says locals have really banded together and made them feel included. Now he says anytime they go into town, it takes an hour because they always stop to chat with people they care about and who care about them.
It's been unbelievable.
Yes.
It's been enriching. We are blessed.
They're not the only ones. After the fire destroyed 127 homes here, people in the community and across the country sprang into action. Groups like the Red Cross descended on the town, and donations of clothing and money and furniture poured in. Marcy saw her neighbors take care of one another like never before.
The help and support and caring that they've had.
The relationships.
You know, this is just the relationships that they've formed.
Yeah.
I mean, this has just been, it's not just us, this is tons of people. Their lives are different. Our lives are different.
Over in Glen Isla, a neighborhood hit particularly hard by the fire, Linda Ma standing next to a burned-up frame of what used to be a dining room chair.
There, have a seat.
Her house and the trees that surrounded it are gone, and only now has the smallest frame of her future home appeared. But Ma looks happy and calls her barren lot filled with boulders a moonscape.
I became a kinder and softer human being because of this whole, you know, incident.
Maybe it's because she threw herself into helping others. Ma's one of the members of the Yarnell Hill Recovery Group, created right after the fire. So far, the group has raised about $2 million to help people rebuild and ensure that life will go on here.
I'm in awe of the experience. I mean, tragic, yes, but it's really brought everyone together.
Ma says it reminds her of her old home of San Francisco and how friendly people were in the wake of the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989. She remembers that vibe disappearing after a few days.
But here, it just continues.
I have never been this nice in my life to deserve all the wonderful things that have happened to me since the fire. I know I haven't been this good.
That's Debbie Keener. She and her husband Steve are sitting on their porch. Their new porch on their new home built with funds from the Yarnell Hill Recovery Group. Their old home, which they had lived in for decades, burned to the ground, along with almost everything they had, except for their vehicles, dogs, and a few odds and ends. But don't expect to hear a hint of negativity in their voices.
We have so much to be grateful for. And the biggest loss with everything had to be the firefighters.
Steve says that tragedy can make it hard to enjoy their good fortune and keeps them forever humble.
They gave everything they had. And I don't want anybody to ever forget them and what they did.
That's why right now, 19 little American flags are flapping in the breeze on the porch's railing. Steve says you can expect to see them every June. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
The document dated July 4th, 1776 begins with these words. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. It is a declaration. It is the Declaration of Independence, of course. But Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Joseph Ellis says, take a close look at what the Declaration is not. He says it's not a declaration of unity or cohesion. In fact, Ellis believes July 4th, 1776 is not the day the United States became a nation. Rather, he wants us to look a little later, to 1783, when four founding fathers undertook what he calls the most creative and consequential act of political leadership in American history. That idea is at the heart of Ellis's latest book. It's called The Quartet, Orchestrating the Second American Revolution, 1783 to 1789. And Joseph Ellis joins us now. Thanks for joining us on Here and Now.
My pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. So the Second American Revolution, why? What happens in 1783 to 1789 that deserves such a title, such a mantle?
Well, the period, the 1780s, is a kind of black hole in American history. Nobody knows what happens then. Most Americans, even historically literate Americans, don't. And the person most responsible for the misunderstanding is Abraham Lincoln.
Mr. Lincoln?
Mr. Lincoln.
And why?
What do you think is the most famous speech in American history, Megan?
The one I had to memorize in, let's say, what was it, the sixth grade, the Gettysburg Address.
And the first clause in the first sentence, see if you can come along with me. 47 years ago,
our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty,
and dedicated to the proposition
that all men are created equal.
And the last part lets you know that 47 is 1776, right?
Right.
And the answer to his question, you know, he's wrong. America doesn't create a nation in 76. It creates a confederation of sovereign states provisionally united to win the war and then go their separate ways, which is what they do.
In fact, there's nothing in the Declaration that calls America a united nation.
No. In fact, when people talk about the United States, they talk about it as a plural noun. The United States are, okay? Mm-hmm. And the resolution for independence voted on July 2nd from the Virginia delegation is, this is what they voted on, it is the formal Declaration of Independence, that these colonies are and have every right to be independent states.
Right.
We don't rebel as a nation. We rebel as a confederation of sovereign states. And the reason that Lincoln has to get it wrong is because the position that is historically correct is the position of the Confederacy in 1861.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. Of course. He couldn't actually look to true history because he would be supporting...
He's got to get history wrong in order to be morally right.
Okay. Well, you know, we could spend an hour talking about whether or not Abraham Lincoln, you know, how calculated he was in doing that, which obviously he
persuaded himself it was true.
Okay. So let's go back then that fourscore prior to the mid-19th century. The revolution, the battles of the revolution are over, but there is this political battle that 13 loosely confederated states are undergoing.
That's right. And basically, all the energies from the end of the war onward are centrifugal rather than centripetal. Everything is spreading out. Nobody, if you think about it, the argument they've been making against the king and parliament is we don't want to be represented by any faraway government.
So why would they want that?
Why
right
would
here
they want to create at a time when the average American is born, lived out his or her life, and dies within a 28-mile radius? Government is local. Government is what you can see with your own eyes and trust because you're a neighbor and he's a neighbor or she's a neighbor. And so the creation of any kind of government located far away seems to be inherently tyrannical and seems to repeat the very mistakes they think they've avoided in the revolution. Anyway, that's the direction that history is headed. We're headed towards the EU. It's going to be the American Union. It's going to be a confederation of sovereign states. And obviously something happens to change that direction. And I'm arguing that this is one of those cases where, well, we always prefer change to come from the bottom up.
Right.
This comes from the top down.
And it comes from the top down in your book, in your view of this history, from what you call the quartet.
Right.
George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison. And basically what we're talking about is their influence in terms of what becomes the Constitution
right.
of the United
That's
States
right.
of America. Now, it's so interesting to me because you're right. Like, we kind of, in most classes, we skip from roughly 1776 then to 1789-ish.
Right, right.
But in that interim period, I mean, I'm looking at, for example, John Jay was talking about the Articles of Confederation at the time, which ends up getting wiped off the table. He says he's looking forward to evils and calamities in terms of the future.
They think that the Confederation is about to dissolve. European pundits abroad, especially in England, are looking forward to the dissolution of America so they can come back and recover what they lost in the war. There is a pretty clear consensus that anarchy or civil war is in the making.
I mean, Washington even says in a speech around this time that civil discord could lead to a deluge, a deluge over the rising empire of the United States, a deluge in blood.
Yeah, and one of the little insurrections out here in the western part of our Commonwealth called Shays' Rebellion mm-hmm. is a kind of triggering event. They exaggerate the significance of that. I live out there, so we know how it feels to be a colony out there in Boston. And
some things never change.
No, they don't. But it's used as a triggering event because it seems to be a harbinger of future anarchy. And these four guys end up first forcing the calling of a convention, making sure Washington participates. That's a big deal. He legitimizes this. Controlling the agenda, writing the Federalist Papers to manage the ratification process, and then single-handedly Madison writes the Bill of Rights.
Right.
So that's in the book, what I'm arguing they do to get us to the government. The government is a semi-national government. The U.S. is still not a nation in 1788-89. I don't think it becomes a nation until after the Civil War.
Right.
But it's a federal structure in which you can argue about the relationship between church and state deliberatively rather than violently.
Well, can we just talk for one second about Washington? I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's funny because he's probably the best known of the quartet, but maybe not for all the right reasons, because we talk about his role in the war, in the revolution. And, you know, as you lay plain in the book, he took a lot, even though he was concerned, deeply concerned about the direction the nation was heading, if it wasn't heading towards this more federal system.
Right.
He took a lot of lobbying to sort of come on board and be the figurehead.
He really didn't want to do it. He, when he became president, no president in American history did not want to be president than George Washington.
You write in the book that he said, he finds the occupation of rural life on Mount Vernon so congenial with my feelings that to be drawn into public life at this advanced age would be a sacrifice that could afford no compensation.
Remember, too, he surrenders his sword at the end of the war and becomes the American Cincinnatus, the Roman general that retires swords into plowshares. Once Cincinnatus retires, he can never go back. Mm. That's what Washington is saying. It takes a lot to convince him to come back. And what they end up convincing him is his own legacy is at stake.
Yeah. So in the book, The Quartet, you mean you write in beautiful detail about sort of the political machinations and process by which these four go through to get to what becomes the Constitution and the Bill
right.
of Rights, as you write. It's not a perfect document by any means,
no.
a stretch of the imagination. It's not what Alexander Hamilton wanted.
No.
But completely.
But I wonder, I mean, to just take a quick step back in the last little bit of time that we have, you write so wonderfully about the quarrelsome process, essentially, that was the formation of the Constitution and how essential that is to what we recognize today as American democracy. I mean, not so much of what it looks like on paper, but what it was in practice. That was our first sort of view of it.
Yeah, it is. The Constitution doesn't provide answers. It provides arguments. Argument is the answer. It creates a framework in which the arguments can continue. The whole notion of original intent doesn't work because the original intent is not to hold any generation in the future hostile to their version of the answer. So they want to prolong the period of intense deliberation. The Constitution established not a democracy but a republic. A republic is committed to the public interest, not the popular interest. The popular interest is short range. The public interest is long range. It filters the popular interest through layers of deliberation. That's the secret of a republic against a democracy. But anybody that looks back has to be impressed with the leadership at this moment, which might be the most consequential act of leadership in American history.
Joseph Ellis is a historian and a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His book is The Quartet, Orchestrating the Second American Revolution, 1783 to 1789. Professor Ellis, thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
With the war in eastern Ukraine at a seeming stalemate, some Ukrainian politicians are calling for the area of land controlled by pro-Russian rebels to be completely cut off from the rest of the country. But even if Ukraine doesn't take that step, the region is already being isolated. That's because new restrictions at Ukrainian army checkpoints are making it difficult for goods and people to cross into and out of rebel territory. The BBC's Tom Burridge reports.
So this is probably the most spectacular sight I've seen since I've been in eastern Ukraine. I'm walking down a wooden bridge, and to the right of me is an abyss. The concrete bridge that was here has been completely blown apart. It's snapped in two. The old road just leads down below me, and I've now crossed from Ukrainian-controlled territory into rebel-controlled eastern Ukraine. And this is an area where there has been shelling on a regular basis, but it's a crossing that people are trying to make every day.
Oksana is distraught. She told us her husband had run off with their young daughter out of rebel territory, over the bridge, and across the makeshift border. She was desperate to try and find them, but she hadn't been allowed to cross.
I can't imagine life without my daughter. The soldiers just told me to go home and bring up my son.
Pulling her empty shopping basket in the midday heat was 65-year-old Alexandra. The Ukrainian authorities have made it harder for goods and people to move in and out of rebel territory. Alexandra just wanted to cross the bridge to get food to eat.
Life is very difficult. My son just had an operation on his lung, so he can't work. We're living on $55 a month. That's why I try and cross. But this month they're not letting me through. Over there, a relative gave me a few potatoes and a bit of milk because they have a cow, or I buy something else. That's how we're surviving. It can't be called poverty. It's destitution.
And with restrictions on the flow of goods over the de facto border, food now costs much more in rebel-held cities like Lugansk.
So Nina is selling all types of pastries, biscuits and sweets here at her store. And she says her prices have doubled in the last 6 months.
With an increase in the fighting in recent weeks, Ukraine has closed some of the handful of crossing points. So Yelena is also stranded on the rebel side, unable to reach her husband and home over the bridge.
How am I meant to feel? Humiliated. Broken. Some people who don't have relatives in Luhansk have to stay here at the checkpoint overnight.
The Ukrainian authorities say that increased restrictions are necessary security measures. But the women we met feel trapped on one side of a bridge which is increasingly cut off from the rest of Ukraine.
The BBC's Tom Burridge reporting from eastern Ukraine. Summertime means summer books, and if you're looking for suggestions on what to put on this season's reading list, we've got two experts here to help. Petra Mayer is an editor at NPR Books. Hi there, Petra.
Hi.
And R.A. Washington is co-owner of Guide to Culture, a bookstore in Cleveland, Ohio. R.A. Washington, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to have both of you. So Petra, first let me just ask you, are summer books or the books you want to read in the summer any different from those, say, that you might want to read in the fall or winter?
For me, no, but I think that's because the books that I read all year round, other people would class as summer reading. The distinction I would actually draw is that there are books that you want to read on vacation. And that's not necessarily summer, right? But if you're giving your brain a break, you're not possibly not going to break out the Proust, although our listeners are all such elevated folks. I don't know.
I was going to say, some people say that's on the top of their list.
That's true. I would say that on vacation, I certainly want things that are more relaxing, that I can dive into without having to do much heavy swimming against the current.
Mm. And R.A., I mean, what typifies a great summer read for you?
I like to read poems in the summer.
Mm.
I just find that, you know, my attention span is not as motivated for a longer piece of literature.
Yeah.
So you can read a couple of poems and feel good about yourself.
That's a good point. Short is key in the summer, mm-hmm. or on vacation.
Well, I mean, actually, on that note, R.A., what are some of your poetry recommendations for folks?
One of them is called Sand Opera by Philip Metris, who is a professor at John Carroll here in Cleveland. This book is told from the perspective of people who are in prison in Abu Ghraib.
Uh-huh.
It's a look at it from another angle that you probably wouldn't even think about, and let alone think that poems would be written about it. And the Alice James publishers just did a gorgeous job with the layout and design of the book. I mean, it has the CIA blackout pages that are on vellum, and it has all these wonderful cutaways, and it's just a really poignant and complete piece of literature.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about it.
It does sound quite compelling. I mean, especially the notion of poetry from the perspective of an Abu Ghraib prisoner. Petra, I mean, what's on the top of your list for a summer read?
Well, the book that I have been raving about nonstop to everybody ever since I read it a couple months ago is Uprooted by Naomi Novik. It's a kind of reworking of Beauty and the Beast. Naomi Novik has some Polish heritage, and the book is set in a fantasy version of Poland. And, you know, there's a village, there's a sorcerer on the edge of the village, and he takes a girl to his tower every 10 years and teaches her magic, and he wards the villages against the wood that's encroaching on them. And so we pick up with this one girl who has just been selected to go to the tower. I love the way this book plays with all the familiar tropes of fairy tale and fantasy literature. There's, you know, the quest and the mysterious sorceress and the chosen girl and the evil wood. And then it kind of dodges a different path around all of these things. Mm. And it's just the most colorful, lovely, enveloping world that Novik creates. And one of the strongest things about it, I think, are the two female characters, the main character and her best friend. Because so often when female friendship is depicted in literature, it's sort of frenemies or catty or backstabbing. And the friendship between these two girls is so real and so strong and so flawed. They are strong characters in the best sense of being strongly written. And you want to just follow them through this adventure. It's actually a little bit complicated for me for a vacation read, but you just get drawn along by these two girls and what's happening to them.
All right, does that sound good to you?
It sounds great to me. I like fantasy books, and I especially like women protagonists.
Well, Ari, I didn't want to leave. I know we're sort of skirting back and forth here, but I did want to talk about another poet that I know is someone that you wanted to call attention to as a great read for the season, Amiri Baraka.
Yeah, I know that sounds strange. Oh, Amiri Baraka, summer reading. But they recently released in February his poems from 1961 to 2013. And it's the book is amazing because it takes you through the four periods of Amiri Baraka. And if people don't know about him, he starts off as Leroy Jones, and he writes this Obie Award-winning play called The Dutchman, and He knows Frank O'Hara and he knows Allen Ginsberg and all these folks. And then Malcolm X is assassinated, and he leaves that entire life that he's created, where he's this award-winning playwright and goes to Harlem and opens up a school and, you know, has these concerts where Sun Ra's playing on a platform, and he writes these poems. And in his third period of his life, you know, he moved back to home to Newark and became this sort of political entity in Newark, using poems as protests. And his fourth period, his later years, is reflecting on what he lost by being such a staunch critique of the capitalist system and all these things. So the poems have this sadness toward the back end of the book, where you really get a sense of the man and not just the myth and all the propaganda surrounding him.
So, the collection is titled SOS, right?
SOS, yeah.
It sounds like a powerful collection. And, you know, Petra, I was thinking of something that R.A. said a little earlier. Like, poems are just a great little package to take along with you, so you can just sort of dip in and out of them. And there's no reason why, you know, in the summertime we can't take stuff that really packs a punch with us, you know, whether we're going to the beach or taking a vacation.
Oh, absolutely. No, that power and that compactness is just wonderful.
Yeah. But on the other hand, Petra, I mean, there's a lot of great nonfiction, too, out there right now. And I know that there's one on your list as a great potential summer read.
Yeah. And it's actually a book that sort of the tagline is that it's specifically about summer. It is The Fly Trap. And I'm going to mess up this name, I'm absolutely sure, because I'm not Swedish. So if any Swedes out there would like to correct me, it's Fredrik Sjöberg or Sjöberg, I'm not quite sure. But he's an entomologist, and he lives on a tiny island in Sweden. He studies hoverflies, just this one particular kind of fly, of which maybe a couple hundred species live on this island in Sweden. And within this stricture, he finds so much freedom and so much joy and so much interest. And the book, you know, it's a memoir by a Swedish entomologist who lives on a tiny island. And it's just, it sort of defies summary, because you read it and he's so funny and he's so observant and he's so, you know, his wit is so dry. You want to go hunting flies with him.
It sounds terrific. Before we run out of time, R.A., there's a... You know, we're genre hopping here, so I want to hit one more before we have to wrap up, and that's the genre of memoirs, because you've got a really interesting one on your list. Black Flags and Windmills, Hope, Anarchy, and the Common Ground Collective by Scott Crowe. Tell us about that.
Scott Crowe was involved in this collective that helped during Hurricane Katrina and, you know, essentially helped the community keep their housing, because people were looting each other, and so they were like armed guards and food programs. And he talks about it from the breakdown of FEMA, from the breakdown of the local structure, but really highlights how the people kind of rose together and took care of each other. And then he talks about it at the same time how he kind of evolved in his thinking, you know, his journey as a white man who's supposed to, you know, go this one path and choose this other path, and how it alienates him from his family and friends and ultimately creates this whole new life he never would imagine for himself. It's a really great read.
And Petra, before we wrap up here, I do need to ask you that this is NPR Books Summer of Love, and you're focusing on romance novels?
Yeah, speaking of things that are really perfect reads anytime, but particularly in the summer, we are focusing on romance novels. Our big reader poll this year is about people's favorite romance novels. And we're just celebrating a wonderful genre that's often overlooked and doesn't get a lot of mainstream critical attention. And if I had to recommend one book, it would be The Lion's Daughter by Loretta Chase, which is a wonderful swashbuckling romp set partly in Albania and partly in Regency England.
Petra Mayer is an editor at NPR Books. Petra, it was great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And R.A. Washington, co-owner of Guide to Culture, a bookstore in Cleveland, Ohio. R.A., it was a real pleasure to speak with you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This week, health officials announced 3 new cases of Ebola in Liberia. One victim has died. And this is a setback and a surprise because barely 2 months ago, the country was declared Ebola-free. Here to talk more about Ebola in Liberia is Michaeline Duclef, editor of NPR's Science Desk and the deputy host for Goats and Soda, NPR's global health and development blog. And Michaeline, first of all, tell us, what do we know about who these new victims are and how they contracted the disease?
So this past Sunday, health officials in Liberia found out that a 17-year-old boy died of Ebola in a small village just outside Monrovia, the capital city. And immediately, like within hours, a big team of health workers, including U.S. scientists, rushed to the village and started testing people for Ebola and tracking down anybody who came in contact with him. And then over the course of the next few days, they realized that at least 2 more people have Ebola, and both of those people have been put into a treatment center. And there's probably a couple more people that have it. They're expecting the outbreak to get bigger. How these people caught it, that is the big question and the big concern. They really have no idea right now where this boy got the virus. And that's a big concern, because if they don't know where he got it, then they don't know if other people caught it at that same source, too.
Does this mean that they don't know if it came from surrounding countries or from within Liberia?
Exactly. I mean, at first there were rumors that he had traveled up near Guinea and Sierra Leone, which both of those countries still have about 10 or 12 cases a week. But those rumors turned out to be false. And actually, there's no evidence that he traveled outside of his community, which is very far from the border of Guinea or Sierra Leone. There's also no evidence that he came into contact with somebody who had come from one of those countries. So that really leaves 2 major possibilities. One is that there's somebody in that region had Ebola and they didn't know it, which is a pretty scary scenario because it means they could be infecting more people. The second one is that he caught it from an animal. Mm-hmm. So we know that Ebola likes to hang out in bats, but it also infects other animals. And a Liberia health official actually said that they're looking into contaminated dog meat as a possible source. The 3 people that are known to have Ebola right now in that village actually shared a meal of dog meat. And so they're looking right now to see if animals in the village are infected with Ebola.
Well, this is incredibly disturbing news because, of course, as we remember, the Ebola outbreak in Liberia so devastated the country practically. So what has been the reaction from health officials?
It's been huge. I mean, this is bad news, and everybody is, you know, kind of on edge about it. But at the same time, they're not completely surprised that there are new cases. Even though Liberia was declared Ebola-free, the outbreak in West Africa was by no means over and actually is still out of control in some parts of Guinea and Sierra Leone. And so I think that as long as there's this constant source of cases in the virus, they were expecting Liberia to have more cases. I think they weren't expecting it to be such a mystery as to where this virus came from.
Mm. And as you mentioned, even though Liberia had been declared Ebola-free 2 months ago, surrounding countries are still really struggling with this. So has this, you know, put the entire region once again on high alert, on edge?
I definitely think it's putting the capital city, Monrovia, on high alert, right, and on edge. You know, that's where the outbreak really got out of control last October. And, you know, they were reporting like 500 cases a week. But at the same time, you know, the health officials I talked to yesterday, including the director of the CDC here in the U.S., Dr. Thomas Frieden, you know, he said Liberia is a totally different place in terms of its ability to deal with Ebola outbreaks than it was last summer. It has a huge amount of tools and infrastructure to stop these outbreaks. They have Ebola treatment centers, and they have health workers who can take care of people, who can, you know, diagnose the virus. That said, I think everyone is kind of nervously waiting to see if that really happens. Can they stop the spread from these 3 people before it jumps to another village or to another town or into the capital?
Right, especially since they don't yet know exactly how it came back as well.
Yes, and there's always this kind of lingering worry or concern is that it actually never left Liberia. The rural parts of Liberia are really rural and they're hard to get to. And a few health officials I talked to said, you know, surveillance there. So that means like, you know, actually actively looking for the virus is impossible in some parts. And so there could be cases that have kind of just lingered on throughout the country. And again, we'll never really stop the virus until we stop it in both Sierra Leone and Guinea as well.
Well, that's NPR's Michaeline Duclef speaking to us about the recent Ebola cases in Liberia, which had been declared Ebola-free. Michaeline, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.